Hi, I'm Tedra Meyer, Vermont Edition producer, and I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited down a bit for clarity and brevity. Hope you like it. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. These days, libraries aren't just keepers of physical books, though of course that's still a big reason why many of us go. People also go to libraries to use their computers, attend talks and classes, access online resources, snag some free COVID tests, or use the restroom and take shelter from the cold. That is a lot. So with all these responsibilities, how are Vermont's libraries and librarians doing? That's the subject of a new report by a working group established and funded by the Vermont government. All kinds of stakeholders worked on it. Librarians from towns, public schools, colleges, and universities, and folks from organizations that work closely with libraries. Now, here to help us talk through the state of Vermont libraries is Catherine Delneo. She's the Vermont State Librarian and Commissioner of Libraries and the chair of the working group that created this report. Kathy, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Michaela.
And from Montpelier, we're also joined by Christopher Kaufman Ilstrup. He's the Executive Director of Vermont Humanities, and he was also part of the working group that worked on this report. Welcome.
Thanks for inviting us.
Now, Kathy, this is a really thorough report on the state of libraries with days worth of testimony collected. I tried to count. It comes out to around 200 pages. Can you tell us a bit about the process that went into creating this before we dive into what you actually found?
Absolutely. It's a really long report, and it's a really in-depth report. And that's because the working group was established by the Vermont legislature, and we had a huge charge. So we were supposed to look at almost every area of library service, and we were given 2 years to study and report back on our findings. The first step was to assemble the participants and their stakeholders from all different areas of Vermont life that intersect with libraries. So school librarians, academic librarians, public librarians, folks like Christopher, who's from Vermont Humanities, and Andy Kolovos, who works at the Vermont Folklife Center. So we had library trustees, which Andy also, he's got two hats. So we convened, and initially, I wasn't even there at the very beginning. Our interim state librarian before me, Tom McMurdo, got the group together, and they decided to hold sessions on specific topics in our purview over the course of the 2 years. And we were originally going to have 12 meetings, but we had to expand it to 17 meetings to really cover all of the topics. And we did these marathon sessions, and I really value the time that folks put into it, because we would meet about 5 hours, and we would hear reports from the department staff about statistics and data at the state level and the national level. We brought in experts on different topics to hear from them, both experts in Vermont and experts around the country. And then we heard from Vermonters themselves. So some of those were librarians and library staff, library trustees, but also Vermonters who were passionate and wanted to share their ideas about libraries and what was going well and what needed to be improved. And then the chapters of the working group, the original draft chapters, were actually drafted by each of the working group members, and they were combined with the reports from the department, and that's what you have in front of you with this 220 some odd page report that we've issued. So that's what you're looking at. We also found out that people really were concerned about salaries and benefits of public librarians in the state. And so the working group decided to commission a study on that topic. So the appendix has that full study, which is another 100 pages. And we realized that we didn't know that much about technology in libraries. So the department staff worked on a technology and broadband survey. That's in the appendix too. And then if you're wondering what makes up the rest of the appendix, it's some of those reports from experts, but it's actually the words of Vermonters about libraries. So we included all of the written comments we received. And that is really a testament to that participation level is really what makes this report so long, because people really wanted to share what they thought about Vermont's libraries and each of those different topics. And we thought their words were really valuable and should be kept in the appendix so that they didn't just kind of disappear over time. This was really a labor of love for the library community, and we wanted to commemorate that in the report.
Well, Kathy, as I was telling you before the show, I have to read a lot of reports for this job, and I found this report surprisingly readable. I don't know if it was because it was by librarians who are around great books all the time, but there was so much in there and a lot of really interesting takeaways for all of us who have a library in our lives and see firsthand some of the struggles that librarians are facing. And we'll get to those in just a moment. But first, Christopher, you were on the working group that helped gather data for this report. You also helped write it. Can you tell us how you got involved and the specific roles you played?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for asking. I started with the working group at the very beginning. I was one of the folks listed in the enabling legislation. So there I was, appointed to the group. And it was truly an honor to be participating in these meetings and hearing from so many dozens and dozens of Vermonters who were really passionate about their libraries, both their school libraries and their community libraries or public libraries. And one of the big takeaways for me really is that the stories of libraries in Vermont are really the stories of Vermont communities at large, right? That we heard about how difficult it is to maintain old and historic buildings in the same way that we know old and historic housing stock in Vermont is struggling right now. We heard about how hard it is to put together a life as a library employee when you can only work 10 or 12 hours a week in that job, and then you have to maybe get a job at a different library to add another 10 hours and then maybe 20 hours at the coffee shop to put together a full-time experience. We heard about people's experience with accessing healthcare. All of those stories were really similar to the policy discussions we're having writ large in Vermont, and I thought that was very moving to see that through the library lens. I will also say, of course, there were some special things as well about libraries that are very unique, and that really is about how we build community in Vermont and how we access information and how we reflect each other to each other. Mm. And that's a big important part of this report is the role that libraries play in building a sense of community and of social capital in the state.
Mm. Well, you both brought up the idea of being able to pay librarians competitive living wages. So let's start there. Catherine, what were some of the findings around librarian and staff pay?
Well, as Christopher was saying, it really seems to mirror what we're seeing in general in Vermont, that important jobs sometimes folks are struggling to make ends meet. And what we heard from – what the working group heard from the community was that that the pay that they're receiving may not be commensurate with the difficulty of the job, and that they really – have to cobble together positions sometimes. There are many different sizes of libraries open, many different hours, and that contributes to this issue. But really, for me, when we look at the chapter about the library structures and organizations, it really comes back to a funding issue, and that our incorporated and municipal public library funding is kind of all over the map. So there are great disparities that we see between large, small libraries, and that as the cost of benefits goes up, as the cost of collections goes up, libraries are struggling to make ends meet. So we did commission this study, and we really saw that many library staff in the state don't have benefits, and that's a key concern for lots of folks. Mm.
Full-time librarians?
I have to look and drill down into it a little bit, but there was a lack of benefits reported by both part-time and full-time librarians in both incorporated or nonprofit libraries and also in municipal libraries. Mm. So that was something that we had heard about. And so we did a study where the The study was done by having library directors across the state respond to the questions. And it was a bit dismaying and sobering for us to find this through our work.
Christopher, what are your thoughts there?
Well, you know, I would also add that what librarians are expected to do for the compensation on offer is really remarkable, right? They're generally required to have a master's level education to become a librarian and the commensurate student debt that goes with that. But in many community libraries all across the country, and certainly in Vermont, people are also expected to be able to manage a historic building and all of the rules and regulations that come with that. They're expected to be able to help provide social services in a situation where many vulnerable people are coming into libraries because they're the only public, warm, safe space that's available. We heard from a lot of librarians that are struggling with safety and security issues in their buildings. And so when we're facing a situation where librarians can't make ends meet, where we're not funding the libraries at the level they need to be funded, we really have to look at that broad picture of what we're expecting from our library staff and whether or not that is actually sustainable over the long haul.
I should also note listeners might be hearing some sound behind you. That is the sound of construction on the building in Montpelier that you're in following some flood damage. So We are in the midst of it, and we actually should talk about the flooding and its effects on libraries. But first, let's go to the phones. We have a call from Gordon in Stowe. Gordon, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say what a precious resource Vermont libraries are. My mother was a librarian in Chester in the 80s, and her and another librarian started a project called the Vermont Reading Project, I believe, and they would take illiterate people from the inner cities, put them on buses, bring them to Vermont libraries, and teach them to read. I'm not quite sure where that project's at now. That was a long time ago. But it's absolutely, we have to find a way to fund these libraries so we don't lose them. Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, thank you so much, Gordon, for calling in. Yeah, that question of funding seems to be right at the center of this report, Kathy, and a call for support. I was particularly moved by the conclusion of one section about how Vermont libraries are providing social services to disadvantaged members of the community. And I'm just going to read a line here. It says, Vermont librarians care deeply about the communities they serve and feel that individuals in crisis should receive the help they need. Vermont librarians are also straining under the demands placed upon them to serve as frontline social services providers, particularly to patrons in acute crisis. The libraries request support to address community needs they are poorly equipped to serve, to solve. Kathy, this feels like a really real cry for help from Vermont's librarians.
Absolutely. We do know that right now Vermont's libraries are struggling with maintaining the ability to provide core services. And as Christopher said, the scope of librarians' work has really changed over the years. At one point in the past, it may have been really focused primarily on print collections and then programs for the youngest kids to support literacy. And then that's been expanding and expanding and providing reference services the whole time, of course. I hear from librarians every day. In fact, I was talking with a library director yesterday evening about this, that the dynamics are changing now. And the working group really has heard from folks that the social service needs that people have related to experiencing homelessness or suffering with mental health crises or drug addiction are impacting libraries' abilities to provide those core services. It's difficult to provide a welcoming and friendly and safe space when people who really need support are coming into the library and may be in a moment of crisis. So librarians are turning to learning de-escalation techniques and trying to learn more about which services they can connect people with. But it does really challenge people in the day-to-day, and it does impact library services overall.
And sorry, just to jump in here with another quote from Mary Danko of Fletcher Free Library in Burlington. She writes about adrenaline rushing situations that demand nuanced thinking around patron behavior, including mental health and substance abuse issues. And I have to say, hearing it phrased in that way reminds me of the conversation we had just yesterday here on Vermont Edition with the outgoing executive director of Groundworks Collaborative, a shelter in Brattleboro, where they've experienced real tragedy there by clients. And these risks are real. I wonder if it leads to turnover with staff?
Absolutely. One of the things that we heard during the day that we spoke about staffing, we spoke about staffing a few times, but the primary day that we heard folks share comments about staffing was that people are having a hard time retaining staff. If the environment is more erratic, it can be really hard to feel like you're bringing your best self to work every day. We have been at the department, we've been trying to provide resources around self-care, but it's difficult to go back into work each day when there are challenges that are coming out in your workplace, in your space. The wonderful thing about a public library is that it's free, it's open to everyone, and it's welcoming. And we want that place to be safe as well. Mm-hmm. And so I think staff are really doing their best to de-escalate and to call in help when they need it, but it can be pretty challenging for folks. And what used to be seen more as an urban issue, we were hearing about from folks all around the state in rural communities. People shared that if they don't have a local police force, it can be quite hard to get support if there are challenging behaviors that come out in the library setting.
Mm. Whereas some libraries, like ones in Burlington, like Fletcher Free, which we were just talking about, or just down the road from a police station, there are others in more rural parts that are very far from either police or a social services center where people could come assist.
Right. So you might even see libraries evaluating, can they stay open in the evenings, or what kind of a staffing complement do they need? So it's just another dynamic. Public safety is now a dynamic that many areas of life we have to think about. I'm sure it's not just specific to libraries, but it is definitely something that impacts staff, because some of the time they might have been planning a program or helping a library patron connect with a resource or teaching someone to use a database. It's hard to do that when it's interrupted. And so people were expressing that to the working group that they don't necessarily feel they're able to provide the best service in those circumstances. It's very challenging at times.
And let's go right back to the phone. So we have a call from Merlin in Lisbon, New Hampshire. Merlin, welcome back.
Hello. I have something that everybody out there ought to pay attention to, and that is that any town, any civilization's, the body of knowledge they have is not in a school, it's in a library. If you don't have a library, you don't have a school. If you go ahead and put all your eggs in one basket and put libraries on disks and put it in a computer, one EMP will wipe that out. But a book, if it gets wet, you dry it out, you rebind it, you put it on the shelf. This is the most important thing I can think of nowadays. It's not whether a teacher is getting a raise. It's that the damn town has got to start funding the library. And if they don't, we are done.
Merlin, I can hear the passion in your voice. Thank you so much for calling in. Now, it sounds like Merlin is committed to the printed book, but Catherine and Christopher, of course, libraries provide ebooks and digital products as well that people care a lot about and need to access at libraries. Christopher, could you talk a bit to that and the challenges that some libraries are facing, not just to maintain their physical collections, but digital ones as well?
Sure, of course. You know, and I share Merlin's passion very deeply. I grew up in Vergennes, and some of my earliest memories are going to the Bixby Library and being able to have the serendipitous experience of looking for one book, but maybe finding an entirely different book that could be life-changing for an 8 or 9 or 10-year-old. Visiting that library and being able to explore in the stacks and find all these wonderful surprises in the books. I think that he's absolutely right that libraries are the heart of many communities, and supporting our libraries in many different ways is so important for communities to thrive. I will also say that I am a big fan of reading in many different ways, and I know that reading on on iPads where you can make the print as big as you want it to be, listening to audiobooks where you can hear if you can't see the books, is just as important as being able to have a printed book in front of you. And it serves the same purpose of educating and enlightening the community and the people who read it. So I'm also a supporter of public libraries around the state developing systems to provide ebooks and audiobooks and other kinds of digital resources to their communities as well. Purely on an accessibility standpoint, there are lots of Vermonters who can't read a printed book but can listen to an audiobook. Mm-hmm. And being able to have those robust collections is important. Now, the state library has done a lot to encourage audio and ebook resources through the ABLE Library. And I think we can do more to make sure that those resources are available to people. And then there's other, you know, issues around that as well, right? That ebook and audiobook collections are largely licensed from for-profit corporations. They're not purchased from publishers the way that we traditionally think of buying a book for your library. Mm. And so there's data collection issues that come up there, privacy issues that come up there that we need to think about as people who care about intellectual freedom in public libraries.
Mm, interesting. Yeah, Kathy, what are your thoughts there, specifically about the rising costs of ebooks, online databases, not to mention printed books?
Well, thanks, Christopher, for articulating what we heard during the working group and its many meetings on these topics. But it does really concern us that with the proliferation of formats, the cost of maintaining your print collection hasn't changed. And now many Vermonters are also looking to read ebooks and to use online resources. So that stretches the local library budgets. And that's one reason that the Department of Libraries is doing a lot more with our online resources. We have the Palace Project, which we're rolling out to support local libraries in having a core collection of classic titles that have limitless use over time. So aren't a license that's as limited to maybe 20 reads or 2 years or 3 years. We really have seen in the past few years a change in the purchasing of books because of the difference between, as Christopher was saying, you buy a print book and it's your book for as long as the binding lasts, and then you glue it back together because we're resourceful New Englanders. But the ebooks are licensed differently, the ebooks and e-audiobooks, and you have a limited term either by years or number of checkouts. And it's quite low compared to how a normal book would last, how many uses you would typically get out of it. So that's one challenge that we're finding. With our databases, we're finding that the costs go up and up and up. Sometimes you'll come in as a library with a pretty sweetheart deal, and then once you're hooked on that resource and the community is really using it and knows how to search and to use that database, the costs over time go up. And another thing we're seeing is that with electronic databases and some of the online resources, what you find is that each of those vendors is doing licensing with individuals, and so the content is changing. So you think you've got a certain resource in your collection through the online portal, the online database, but as the database company's access to the specific titles in the collection change, you may actually lose a resource. Or there may be certain titles that aren't included in that collection. You think you've bought the entire New York Times, but actually there are some key articles that are missing, for example. So that's a challenge over time with the licensing and the procurement. Mm-hmm. And kind of to the caller's point, when you have a bound periodical on your shelf, you have access to all of the articles in all of the issues of that magazine. But with a database, it's a little bit harder to ensure that access over time for your academic library or for your school library or your public library.
Mm. It's a bit counterintuitive, isn't it, that sometimes printed materials can provide more longer-term access than digital.
Absolutely. And part of, you know, I was mentioning the length of the report and what we included in it before. Part of the reason we did that is because when you're using resources online, you go to read where the quote came from, and you can't find it anymore. Mm. There's a bit of an ephemeral nature to things that are housed online, and it's difficult to really ensure access to specific collections for people. And so that's something that both the cost of the electronic resources and then also the permanence of them is something that really needs to be looked at. Mm. Sometimes it works really well. In the Department of Libraries, we help people in the state to access the Westlaw database for their work as state employees. And it's working pretty well. I rarely find that there's a problem with that one. But you do hear about issues over time with vendors changing the package, almost like a cable subscription could change what's in a certain tier.
Well, let's go back to the phones. We have a call from Philip in Island Pond. Philip, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. I was glad to hear what the person that was just speaking said about, you know, print books and about what's in them. The bibliographies are so important in books because they reference a lot of the information that are in books. The problem I'm having is we donated books over the years. My mother and I collected books for a better of 50 years, and she passed away a couple of years ago. And we sent 10,000 to auction a number of years ago to a very fine book auctioneer in Boston, and he said, God, what a great collection. And I have thousands left of books. Books, you know, have the information and the answers to today's problems and questions if people would just read them. Sadly, though, I'm finding it very difficult to find a library in Vermont, anywhere in Vermont, that would accept any books. And it disappoints me because, you know, the best universities have great collections of books, especially for research.
Well, thanks for your call, Philip. Kathy, I'm wondering if you can address his concerns there about being able to donate.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that we're all challenged by, and I'd say this about all libraries, is that you have a limited amount of shelf space. So when a local public library that may be a one-room library is offered books, they may not be able to take all of those items. So a local librarian really has to think about the focus of their collection, who they're serving in the community. And so if there's a book that's a scholarly item, it may not be the best fit for your local library. And sometimes what I would recommend to somebody who had an item like that that may have some value is exactly what our listener did, which is offering it through an auction house if it's a valuable item. One thing that we do really well in Vermont is that we share resources. So we have the interlibrary loan system. And for Vermonters listening right now, if you go to your library and the book you want isn't there, it doesn't mean you can't get it. It just means you should walk up to the desk and ask about interlibrary loan because we can get materials from academic libraries, from other public libraries in the state, from school libraries that participate. And that's a way that with our limited building sizes that we can make collections that work for the local folks that we serve, but then also give Vermonters access to academic titles that are, say, in the UVM library or in the Middlebury College Library that people would want to use for studying or exploring or researching in their local rural community.
Mm. Our number is 800-639-2211. If you have thoughts or feedback on what we're discussing with libraries across Vermont. Christopher, there was one part of the report that I was really curious to hear your thoughts on, which is around book bans and censorship. Now, calls for book bans, while increasing in some parts of the country, are pretty rare in Vermont. But the report does say there's a type of soft censorship that's becoming more common in libraries. What is that?
Sure. Yeah. We do see that in libraries across the country and in Vermont. We've heard stories about that. And that's really our wheelhouse at Vermont Humanities is to help people think about libraries as a way into community building. And one of the theories that we always work on is this theory of windows, mirrors, and sliding glass doors, right? Where you should be able to walk into a library or a school and see resources and books that reflect your experience, right? A mirror. You should be able to look through a window and see books and materials that express other people's experience, people that are different from you. And you should be able to walk through that sliding glass door and experience what it might like to be somebody else, to have empathy for other people's experience. And in this conversation about book bans in libraries, what we're really seeing is an effort to close those windows, close those sliding glass doors, cover those mirrors, and often make it harder for people to find materials that really reflect their own experience. There's a great example of that that just recently came up, of kind of soft censorship, where we were working on a book that has been banned in many communities across the country, and a library that we talked to said that they really liked the book, but they might be reluctant to put it sort of in the forefront of their collection or in their display because they weren't sure that their community would be supportive of the book. This happened to be a book that was about the LGBTQ experience, but also written from a BIPOC experience, written from an Asian American experience. It's our Vermont Reads book for this year. Last night at the Telegraph Club, we're happy to send copies out all over the country, all over the state. And that was distressing to hear that there were libraries in Vermont that were feeling uncomfortable with presenting stories about people of color or stories about LGBT folks in an active way. Mm. We also heard a story recently from one of our community partners, Lyric Theater in Burlington. They're presenting The Prom this weekend. It's a big Broadway musical. It's for their 50th anniversary. They wanted to place copies of the script for The Prom in libraries around Chittenden County for people to use in preparation for auditioning. And they found some places got some complaints about putting this script, which happened to be about a young girl who wanted to take her girlfriend to the prom, in a front-placing space in the library. They weren't sure that that was appropriate for their community. And stories like that are rare in Vermont, but not unheard of, and I think we need to be on top of it.
Hmm. And then there's also been complaints and even protests about drag queen story hours at proms as well. Is that covered in the report, Christopher?
Sure. I don't know that we talk about drag queen story hour directly, but one of the recommendations in the report is that libraries should have the ability to protect not just their collections of books, but also their programming choices, and that we should use Vermont's public accommodations law, which protects people from discrimination on the basis of race and gender, mm-hmm. and gender identity, gender expression, sexual orientation, from discrimination. That law applies to libraries, and librarians should be able to present programs like Drag Queen Story Hour if they feel that it's right for their community.
Mm. Well, I would love to dive deeper into this topic, but we have just a few minutes left, and there's a couple other parts of the report that I want to make sure that we get to in this conversation, particularly the impact of the flooding on a couple libraries in Vermont. The two libraries identified in the report that were hit the hardest by the July flooding were in Johnson and Montpelier. And Kathy, one of the parts of this report that I found so interesting was that the ownership of those buildings affected how each library was able to receive federal aid following the flooding. Could you talk us through that?
Absolutely. So in Vermont, about 30%, 35% of our libraries are incorporated public libraries. So that means that when they formed, the community, somebody in the community either donated a building or funded the library, and a nonprofit entity formed that administers that library. Those incorporated libraries provide the same function that a municipal public library does in Vermont. The incorporated libraries are also free and open to the public that they serve. They also go in front of the town at town meeting day and request some funding for library services. There's no real difference in Vermont as far as how incorporated and municipal public libraries operate. In the FEMA structure, the municipal public libraries, such as like Johnson Public Library, which was really significantly impacted by the flood over the summer, they are able to get grant funding through the municipality. With the incorporated public libraries, what we learned is that they're in a different tier. So they are in a tier with nonprofits. So even though they're providing the same function, because of their governance structure, they need to first apply for small business administration low interest loans, and then they may be eligible for some grant funding afterward.
Mm. Well, in the few minutes that we have left, I want to make sure we look towards the future. I want to hear from both Kathy here and Christopher. What comes next? What are your hopes of what will come out of this report? Christopher, we'll start with you.
Sure. You know, I think, I'm going to go back to where I started. I think that Vermonters, as they read the report, should really think about how libraries fit into Vermont issues and Vermont policy conversations as a whole, right? That these are conversations that should be happening within the healthcare realm, within the housing realm, all across state government and community government. We need to be thinking of libraries as an integrated partner in that system. And I hope that this a report will spark people to start thinking of the library as that kind of resource and that kind of central node for those kinds of conversations, and including them as important partners.
Mm. And Kathy, is the goal also to receive more state funding as well?
It's not necessarily to receive more state funding. It's really that the working group wants people to bring much deserved attention to the great work that's happening in libraries and for the decision makers and leaders in Vermont, both in the municipal realm and the state realm, that people look at the value that you're getting for your tax dollars and really that Vermonters support their libraries. The local funding for libraries is actually not on par with the national average for libraries of our size. So I would say that that Vermonters should consider the value of the libraries, the meaning of the library, how it serves the community, what great work they're doing, and how well utilized they already are. And if they value that, then they should really look at supporting libraries and making sure that they continue to have access to that.
Mm. Well, Vermont State Librarian Catherine Delneo and Vermont Humanities Executive Director Christopher Kaufman Ilstrup, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.